Welcome, everybody, to Redacted on this Thursday. I'm Clayton Morris.
I'm Natalie Morris.
And this is a show where we try to cover the news the mainstream media largely ignores. We try to cut through the propaganda. And we've got a lot of news to get to on the show tonight. We're going to look at this TikTok bill, 686. We're going to look at the Josh Hawley version of the bill, which is more of a narrow version of that. The fighting that's been unfolding in Congress over free speech and censorship and what that looks like. So we'll cover that on the show tonight.
We also are going to look at global instability of financial markets as it relates to geopolitics. We have a great guest on today, Nick Bhatia, who wrote the book Layered Money, and I was excited to talk to him about what he thinks is a great alternative to the fiat currencies we're also kind of terrified of lately. Plus, Whitney Webb is going to be here. She's going to tell us about this Epstein deposing of J.P. Dimon. The bank fought like hell for that not to happen. That's I said J.P. Dimon.
Well, you just truncated it instead of J.P. Morgan.
You know,
J.P. Morgan's giant
of J.P.
Dimon.
Morgan
yeah.
did not want to testify in the Epstein trial. A judge ruled that he has to. We're going to pop some popcorn for this one.
Yeah, so Whitney Webb will be joining us in a little bit on that. And was the United States involved in the protests in Israel? Were they there trying to create or foment a color revolution by putting in their own instigators? Well, that's what Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli government thinks about it. So all of that and more as Redacted starts right now. Welcome, everybody.
All right, it's Thursday. Thursday's the new Friday, so let's get crazy. Let's get crunk.
Yeah, let's get crunk. Yeah, so welcome in on the big show. And you know, if you guys really want to piss off YouTube right now, smash that like button. They love to suppress independent media. They love to suppress this type of content, stuff that flies in the face of their narrative. But one thing that they really don't control, and we've seen this repeatedly, is when you actually hit the like button during our live show, it pushes us out into a bigger, larger audience who then can be informed and learn just the way that you guys do. So it's free. Hey, our show is free. All we ask is if you just hit that like button, it'll help us tremendously.
Plus, we want to tell you about our Redacted community. It also comes along with a Redacted newsletter. Now, you can join the Rebellion as a Rebel VIP. You get access to exclusive content that we put there. It also helps us to just keep in contact with you a little bit more closely because social media, of course, is the algorithm is not your friend, as Russell Brand likes to say. So, you know, we really covet a place that we can speak to you without these intermediaries. And so we would very much appreciate if you join our community over there and we offer you some extras. While you're there, you can also sign up for the newsletter. Just put in your email address and that is absolutely free.
Where do they go?
Go to redacted.inc.
All right. Redacted.inc is the website.
Hey, I have an announcement too. I don't mean to like fill everybody with a bunch of announcements right here at the beginning, but today is the last day to get the Silence Equals Complicity t-shirts.
Oh, so. Yes. Did you see the tweet? We have we got a viewer who sent us an image of them. Chris is a veteran and sent us this image. Do you have it?
I'm trying.
Okay.
If you have it, did you put it somewhere?
I put it in the Redacted chat.
Okay.
So,
well, then text it to me.
It was. Anyhow, from Victoria, Canada, said he likes it so much that he and his wife are both going to have matchies, and that's very excited.
There
so this is the last time that you're going to be able to get it.
Yes, there he is. He's a handsome shirt.
It's not on the screen.
Oh, okay.
I'm not seeing it on the laptop. Hang on, let me double check the laptop.
Okay.
All right.
But that's at redactedstore.com.
You got to wait for it because this is a good looking shirt. On a good-looking Redacted viewer, and we are excited about it.
We're getting there.
There it is.
There it is.
Boom.
Veteran. Yes. There he is. Chris,
he did not
Chris
give us permission to send that, but he
it's
sent
on Twitter.
Yeah, he sent it on Twitter, so I think that should be okay. Yes. I hope that's all right. I should have asked.
Well, yes, there it is. Silence equals. We asked people to send. When you guys get the new shirts, please send them to us. Photos of yourself in the new redacted shirt. Yes, today is the last day that you can get the shirt. It ends tonight at midnight, I guess, is what David just said. So,
yep.
So don't be silent, because that's complicity in all of this craziness that we're dealing with right now. All right, let's get to a couple of our top stories today. Let's start with this. Well, first of all, the State Department, the U.S. State Department, just a few minutes ago, issuing a new alert for those Americans traveling to and from Russia. Get out now. Get out of Russia right now. Okay. Well, this is like the fifth time that they've said this.
Yes, it is.
And we're getting word also from the Zelensky camp. There's some weird stuff going on right now in Ukraine as it relates to President Zelensky coming out basically saying, hey, the West has been sending us weapons that don't work. And they know they don't work. Okay. We're also getting reports that tanks are being sent. And this is a really unbelievable report. We're going to dive more deeply into this. That Western tanks are arriving and they're being told, don't put them on the front lines. So what are they then being used for? Are they being used for show? Like, don't put them in the front lines where they'll be destroyed. Just
it's like
them
the
like
stuff
for,
that you give to, you know, those donation groups that maybe come and take stuff off of your front porch. You're
yeah.
Like, just take the stuff we don't want
to. Yeah, but don't put it on the front lines to fight. We want you to just to like have photos with it so you can see it on the, like we can do photo ops with it, but don't use it in battle because they will be destroyed. So don't put them on the front. What the hell's happening here? And then this in Austria.
Yes, politicians in Austria walked out of a speech by Ukrainian President Zelensky on just today. What they did was placed a sign in front of their seats. You see these signs they're pulling out that are pink and blue. The signs say either a place for peace or a place for neutrality. They're sort of alternating. This was from the conservative party called the Party of Freedom. They had warned that if Parliament authorized Zelensky to speak to the entire Austrian parliament, they would stage some kind of demonstration because Austria's current public-facing position is that it supports Ukraine politically, but it will not send weapons or engage militarily in this conflict with Russia because Austria is neutral and its constitution requires them to be neutral. One of the party leaders, Herbert Kiki, said, it is sad that the FPO is the only party in parliament that takes our everlasting neutrality seriously, thereby also standing up for peace. They are the third largest political group in Austria. They have decent representation. They are not fringe, although the media is calling them a far-right group. See the Al Jazeera headline about this today. Austria's far-right lawmakers walk out on Zelensky's speech. So apparently now being peace mongering is a far right thing to do. The left can no longer claim any stakes on peace. But this is a shocking thing to do because we see how much of a media darling Zelensky is.
Right.
And so these people dare to say, we're not getting in on this party. We want peace.
And he's begging for more weapons. Go ahead, David.
First of all, I applaud them. But second, I couldn't hear audio. Was Zelensky already speaking when they did that, or did they do that pre-entering the chamber?
He's there, and he was doing one of his famous Zoom calls. So they had the TVs lined up in the room. He didn't show up there to give a speech.
Yeah, are we able to play it again? You can see, like, there is sort of a pan to the left that you see the video call happening.
Yeah.
Go ahead and play it again if you can. See that in the bottom left? He's speaking. People are, you know, watching, and they are kind of like, we warned you about this.
We're done.
We're not taking sides.
We're out of here.
I was just hoping he saw it.
I wondered the same thing, if he had an in-feed.
There's just a lot of frustration you're hearing coming out of the Zelensky camp today. And, you know, you have to see, and that's why I think you're getting these missiles lobbed back. You know, we're getting weapons from the West that aren't working. We're being told not to use them. They're specifically sending us weapons that don't work, and they know they don't work when they're sending them to us. Like, is he now letting the cat out of the bag? Like, this is clearly what's been happening all along.
Like, he's at an inflection point. Like, maybe we're not set up to win.
Yeah. Maybe we should tell everyone the real truth here now, suddenly. Like, that's what's going on here. It's kind of crazy. And so there's a lot of really weird things happening over the past 24 hours as it relates to Ukraine and Russia. And of course, as you're seeing this U.S. dollar dominance declining, you're going to see more of this saber rattling in the coming weeks as we head into the spring weather. But we want to get to this big story. We have two big bills making their way through Congress right now and that are looking to ban free speech, take away your rights. So let's talk about them. The first, the largest one really is Senate Bill 686, which is known as the Restrict Act, the restricting of the emergency of security threats that risk Information and Communications Technology, the Restrict Act. So this is a bill introduced in the Senate designed to ban the video sharing app TikTok, which would give the Biden administration like all sorts of authority. And not just the Biden administration, then any president after that, right? It would to crack down on transactions between people in the United States and countries deemed, quote, foreign adversaries. So any kind of transaction, it goes beyond just TikTok. It's being talked about as if it's TikTok, but it's way bigger than that, related to information and communications technology. So that's the Restrict Act. It would authorize the Commerce Secretary to also, quote, review and prohibit certain transactions between persons in the United States and foreign adversaries and for other purposes. Vague much?
Well, and when you say that, think about what we were just talking about yesterday, where they'll be able to shut off your finances. They will know that you're making those transactions. So it's like this is opening up exactly what we just talked about yesterday. It's like it's all falling into place.
Well, TikTok is not mentioned by name in this bill, in the Senate bill 686, but the introduction of it comes as Congress, of course, is looking to ban the app separately. Already, like, so they're kind of lumping these together, so we should have that distinction. And of course, the Chinese company ByteDance owns TikTok, and the idea is that, hey, since, you know, TikTok is Chinese owned, then therefore it's obligated to share user data with the Chinese government, and then that can be used as a spying tool. And I love that the United States government says this with a straight face, like after what Edward Snowden uncovered about what the United States government.
Right. It's just so rich.
Right. Like, we're concerned about the Chinese government snooping on people who download TikTok, but you in the United States government through the NSA were literally listening in and eavesdropping on American citizens without their consent, not even through any app that they consented to. It's not like they downloaded the NSA app. And they were using the NSA app that you were ripping off and see, right? They were they were doing it nefariously.
Absolutely.
Well, and it's almost like they're ignoring the Twitter files.
They absolutely are.
Yeah.
It's ignoring the Twitter files. They are trying very hard to ignore the Twitter files.
Well, what do you mean by that for those of our audience that might not understand the context here?
Well, they're watching what people do on social media. The TikTok, the Twitter files have told us that.
Right.
And they're working to censor speech around the Twitter files. But that's less about spying as it is about tracking. But at the same time, I feel like anyone who's mentioned in the Twitter files, like, oh, we censored Christiane Northrup or whatever kind of actor, it must feel like, oh, government actors are watching me and, you know, watching my freedoms. And that must feel scary. I think it's important to wind back the clock just 2 years when President Trump had negotiated with TikTok to unload a portion of its ownership to a domestic country. TikTok said it was willing to do that. They had a deal with Oracle, I believe it was at the time, right? And they were about to do it, and Joe Biden shut that down when he took office. So this could have happened a long time ago. Congress didn't decide to take this seriously until it benefited them. And, you know, at the time, they just were like, this is Trump. He's going to be impeached. He's doing something to distract us. Forget this. We don't care. Oh, all of a sudden they care when they need anti-Chinese rhetoric.
So the FBI and the NSA have a backdoor access tool to Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and a lot of other U.S. tech firms, right? So the FBI and the NSA have a tool, a backdoor access platform to that access. How is this any different? And why have they not stopped this? But we're concerned about China and people using TikTok. And then, like, what does this portend for larger concerns, of course, around around free speech, right? So that's where this second sort of more narrow bill comes into play, where we want to talk about that. That's the, this is the Senator Josh Hawley bill. This is called the No TikTok on United States Devices Act. The idea is that, well, TikTok in its terms of service says, you know, we have access to everything on your device, which I don't understand how exactly that's possible, especially on Apple devices, which are sandboxed, meaning one app is not allowed to have access to other parts of the operating system. Like, that's not allowed to happen. So I'm not exactly sure how that actually unfolds. We know that Facebook was doing the exact same thing, by the way. Facebook got in trouble by Apple because they were, David, maybe you remember, this was about 3 years ago now, but Apple or Facebook got in trouble by Apple. And Apple actually threatened to take Facebook off the App Store when it was discovered that Facebook was like nefariously like patching in. People were wondering like why their battery was draining so much on their iPhones. It's because like Facebook was trying to tap into other parts of the software that they weren't allowed to by getting access to your contacts and certain other things. So I don't remember exactly, but I know that Facebook was doing this. Why don't we ban Facebook too?
Well, and that's the thing, like TikTok does the same thing. And like, if you go into what TikTok actually gets access to, they're actually getting access to your camera, to your microphone and stuff like that. Like it is a lot further than a lot of these other things go. And it's like, there's more detail behind what they're getting with those things. So it is a little bit more, but you're right. It was that's what Facebook was doing, was encroaching on the personal data that Apple says we protect that. And they were getting access to it.
So right. You opt in to use your camera. Like when you download TikTok, I mean, you have to give it access to your microphone. You have to give it access to your camera.
You do, but you're limited on what they can do with that. So, they went beyond the limits of what they're allowed to do with that, like turning it on themselves or whatever. Like there's other tracking things involved with TikTok that they get access to.
Yeah. So it was Oracle and Walmart just 2 years ago that had partnered up, made an offer for TikTok. It was preliminarily accepted. And this was already negotiated under President Trump. This could have been done already.
Right.
But the Biden administration decided it was unnecessarily until now.
Suddenly now it's a big concern because of China, right? Because we want to save. Again, this all comes back to the U.S. dollar. It all comes back to U.S. dollar reserve currency hegemony in the world. And we're using everything that we can right now. We're flying into Taiwan to stir up shit. We're sending ships to the South China Sea. We are doing everything we can right now to saber rattle against China. So let's just go into this Josh Hawley bill. This is the one that's really interesting here. This is the No TikTok on United States Devices Act. Well, not really any more interesting than 686. That's awful enough. But this one got into a heated debate last night on the floor of Congress. We want to bring it to you. So Senator Josh Hawley's bill would prohibit the app from being downloaded in the United States, and it would ban any commercial activity on TikTok with their parent company, ByteDance. And this legislation is much narrower, we should be clear, than the 686 Senate bill, the Restrict Act, which was first rolled out in the Senate. So here is Josh Hawley. I'm going to play first Josh Hawley's defense of this bill, and then I want to play Senator Rand Paul, who really, I think, dismantles and really shows you exactly what's at stake by censoring this app and free speech. Watch.
Senator from Missouri.
Madam President, let me just finish with this, that the Senator from Kentucky decried the collection of personal data by American social media companies, and he's right to do that, by the way. I'm concerned about that too, no doubt. But he pointed out that many American social media companies collect all of this information, that they do it without the user's consent. Sometimes they sell it to third parties for a profit, and you can't necessarily opt out of it. All fair enough, but he is protecting exactly what he decries. The difference is with TikTok, that information is going to a hostile foreign government. It's not a market, it's total control. So I would just say this to Americans out there who are using TikTok. Just know this, we need to tell you the truth about this app. Just know this, if you have it on your phone, it is tracking your keystrokes, it is tracking your movements, it is tracking your location, and it is sending that information, whether you want it sent or not, to Beijing, to the Communist Chinese Party, where it can be accessed by anybody there who wants it under China's national security laws. That is a threat to your personal security, and that is why we should act to ban it. Let me just finally ask Senator from Kentucky, he and I talked about this before, would the senator consider allowing us to set a roll call vote, an up or down roll call vote, not unanimous consent to pass, but to set a roll call vote at a time certain? Would the senator consent to that?
Madam President.
Senator from Kentucky.
Reserving the right to object, I'm unlikely to take First Amendment advice from someone who believes that the First Amendment doesn't protect the Communist Party. You'll find no greater foe of communism, no greater critic. I've been a long-standing critic of, you know, really the funding of research in Wuhan that led to the virus. And yet I still want to protect the basic Bill of Rights, the First Amendment that protects his speech, whether we like it or not. And if someone doesn't understand that communism actually is included under the First Amendment, that terrible speech that we object to is included under that, this is something we should be very wary of. We should beware of people who peddle fear. We should beware of people who peddle half-truths. Almost everything that's been said about collecting data is in all likelihood true, all the social media companies collect data. They devise algorithms. Some of the domestic ones have psychological experiments that might horrify you to see what they've got all the young kids thinking and doing and trying to get them to click on different pictures or trying to get them. This is a marketing stratagem, and they all do it. And they all want to make money, and they all want to get clicks. The difference is this. Many people on the right, in fact, some on the left, they are horrified by big tech in our country. They're consistent in being horrified by the abuses of big tech here and also TikTok. But look at their legislative proposals. Many of them would actually ban big tech here as well, or put it under the thumb of government, or set up government agencies or panels to determine what speech would be acceptable. And if you're not putting enough conservatives on there, by golly, we're going to have a government commission that's going to determine what kind of content gets on there. These are scary ideas. Don't succumb to fear. Don't give up our freedoms. Don't say that, oh my goodness, we're going to ban 150 million Americans. This isn't just about the company. This is about the rights of 150 million Americans to get their content. You're restricting what they can do, and you're restricting what they can use, all with innuendo. Everything that's been said about, oh, this is a channel and a funnel to the government, these are all to the Chinese government. These are all conjecture. These are all things they're saying happen. As far as the sale of the company, I don't think we should force them to sell, but I do believe in a heartbeat they could be sold. They're located in the Cayman Islands. They're incorporated in the Cayman Islands, and they could be sold at any minute. I don't think we should force them to sell. The majority of the shareholders are not Chinese. The two engineers that developed it are, but to say that the algorithm has to reside in China and is in one tiny place and isn't anywhere else is a simplistic notion of the way technology works. The company has bent over backwards to work with our government to try to set up something that would be reasonable, including more government oversight. So I, for one, will say that I will continue to defend the First Amendment, and those who believe that the First Amendment doesn't protect this speech are in the wrong, and they'll find that out when the Supreme Court rules on this. I object.
Objection is heard.
Madam President, I would just say...
So objection and blocking of this bill, and, you know, that seems like, we'll see what happens here on both of these, right?
Now, he brings up the Supreme Court, and I wanted to bring up a case that's currently before the Supreme Court, because I think this is interesting. Right now, in the case United States versus Hansen, this case has asked whether a federal law that prohibits the act of encouraging or inducing unlawful immigration for private financial gain should be struck down as unconstitutional infringement of free speech. As in, is it my right to encourage illegal immigration? Like, if I write a book, let's say, that says, you know, illegal immigration's great, more people should do it because then we have more, you know, of a stronger workforce or what have you, is that my right to do under the First Amendment? Now, interestingly enough, we've seen all of this activity around people on the left and liberals saying that they don't want free speech because they find that it's dangerous around the pandemic, around the vaccine. They don't like free speech around gender ideology. They only don't like free speech when it's free speech that they want to protect. But here we see liberal justice, Sonia Sotomayor. I don't know. Can I call her a liberal justice? I'm going to say she was appointed under Barack Obama. Yeah. She is generally considered liberal. And she does not seem quite open to overruling the law as an overbroad restriction that it violates free speech. Here's something she said in her question on the matter. She said, under this statute, we're criminalizing words related to immigration. And I thought there were only certain statutes that were immune to First Amendment challenges. Yeah, I have a cold. It's not
okay.
Words are not coming out.
I picture that Seinfeld episode when Jerry and Kramer get into it, and he's like, "No,
I did say statute."
He's like, "It's a statute."
Just didn't come out.
Jerry's like, "It's a statute," and Kramer's like, "No, it's a statue."
My words are a little blunted. Excuse me. I am making the case that she thinks that it is dangerous to criminalize words. And that's not a position that's normally coming from the left these days. And I'm slightly surprised. She said otherwise everything else is subject to the First Amendment and strict scrutiny. So why should we uphold a statute, that time I didn't say it right, that criminalizes words? So this is a case to follow. Well, shut up.
Me, I'm kind of like in the camp of like, these are government devices. And so... like if the government is providing that device, just like me as a, like I have Google admin or whatever, Google Suite, I can decide what apps go on anybody that uses my service to connect their phone. So I can decide what apps they can get or whatever. It's kind of the same thing. If the government is providing that phone, they should be able to decide what apps you're putting on it because those phones can get hacked. So I would vote for it in that case. But if it's a phone that they buy and they use on for their personal selves, then I can understand the fight. But in my opinion, if it's just for government devices, I don't think that really falls under the same thing as free speech for us.
Yeah. And I cannot abide this timely caring about things when it's convenient and then not caring about them when it's not. You know, there is no here question of like, oh, are we trying to protect people from, are we trying to protect children because of their self-confidence or anxiety or what have you? Like, that's not even a part of the conversation. It's just feels like it's a pawn in a game that Congress is trying to play.
But that's
part of a bigger narrative.
But that's where it started. It started with, oh, this is we can have that discussion about how damaging it is for kids to be sitting there just like getting these like little videos that
we can and should. And just today we saw Elon Musk adding his name to a document that's asking for computer science experts to put a 6-month pause on artificial intelligence research because he thinks we need to sit and think about what this technology is doing to us. That's an appropriate way to move forward, taking a pause to think about how this technology affects us. But that horse is out of the barn with TikTok a long time ago. The time to have done that has passed. And so the timing of this now is so transparent of who it benefits to talk about this right now.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep our eye on this.
The hold that those apps have on people, imagine if they just deleted TikTok, like kids' lives would explode. I mean, we would have this all of a sudden, this huge influx of mental and social issues and everything if that app went away.
What do you mean?
You know what I mean? I mean, if their app, they live on that app. It's like you're taking that kid's home away from them. They would like freak. It would be crazy.
Can you, Rand Paul makes the point like, oh my gosh, Republicans took away my TikTok.
Yeah.
And they would flip out.
Absolutely.
This might be the thing that they would vote for the very first time in their lives.
You want a civil war? There you
TikTok.
Go.
Yeah.
Take away their TikTok. They'd be forced to go back to Facebook. Can you imagine? Like,
we'll get overrun by preteens.
Yes.
Exactly. The country's yes.
You know that episode of South Park where they close the Denny's and all the old people die because they don't know how to eat? This would be like that, but for young people. They close the TikTok and they would all like melt. Like the Wicked Witch of the West.
What would kids do? I mean, it's crazy. It's an addiction.
Well, I don't know. I asked my daughter, who's 16, and she watches a lot of TikTok. And I was like, what would you do if they actually did shut down TikTok? She just was like, probably just use YouTube stories.
Kids are like, I could use YouTube shorts. You don't want me on TikTok? Then
yeah, I mean, it really is a crazy addiction. I have to tell, like, I'm like, you realize what these companies are doing.
Right, yeah,
with this like short form content and what they're trying to accomplish here, it's really,
right.
Anyway, it's crazy. That's crazy. Well, we've got more news to get to on your Thursday. We're going to look at the deep ties between Jeffrey Epstein and Jamie Dimon. He's about to testify, going to be forced to testify in this U.S. Virgin Islands lawsuit, this Jeffrey Epstein lawsuit. And oh boy, I hope we get some good questions. Journalist, investigative journalist Whitney Webb is going to be joining us for that in just a few moments. But first, are you an investor looking for an easier way to trade stocks? And would you like 17 free stocks? Well, with Moomoo, which is my favorite trading platform, there's no steep learning curve. It's a simple interface. It's easy to use. So even beginners can take advantage of the stock market in no time. Plus, it offers powerful tools often reserved for the experienced investors, like customizable watch lists and advanced charting capabilities. And right now, Moomoo even has a powerful new earnings calendar, so you don't even have to hunt and peck around trying to find the earnings schedule for your favorite companies. Right now, for a limited time, Moomoo is giving away 17 free stocks when you open your account, make your initial deposits. Even if you never do anything else with the account, you get to keep those free stocks. And for our Australian viewers, Moomoo has some great deposit bonuses. When you open your account, you can learn more about the bonuses for our Australian audience when you visit redacted.inc/Moomoo. Now, Moomoo has zero commission trades, and the app looks amazing on every platform, from iOS to Android to Mac and Windows. Moomoo can help you trade with advanced tools like their stock screener, their earnings calendar. So no matter what your skill level is, you'll find fantastic tools that can help you trade. Open your free Moomoo account today. Get access to zero commission trades and 17 free stocks when you open your account and you make your initial deposits. To learn more, check out our link. Go to redacted.inc/Moomoo. That's redacted.inc/Moomoo.
Here's a question we've been discussing. Is the U.S. dollar nearing the end of its global hegemony? Today, I invited a guest to talk about this, and maybe one of the few people that I really wanted to hear from the most during this tumultuous week in global finance. Nick Bhatia is the author of the book Layered Money. I've referred to it often. He's also an adjunct professor of finance at USC Marshall School of Business and founder of The Bitcoin Layer. This is a book that not only explains blockchain currency, but explains the history of currencies and helps really explain what we've been going through, where we've been and where we're going next. I find it an invaluable resource. So, Nick, thank you so much for joining me. I quote your book often because I found it both practical but also prophetic. So why did you write this book? Did you see, because when you wrote it, we weren't in the midst of this financial crisis, but it felt like you saw that coming. Can I ask you, was it just because you were reading the tea leaves, or was it really in the numbers?
Well, the reason I wrote the book is because I wanted to explain Bitcoin in a new way that hadn't been done before. And I knew in order to do that, I had to give a history of money through my lens, which was as a bond market trader. That's the background that I come from. I've spent time in the US Treasury market on a desk, on a strategy desk, and just thinking through the US monetary system from the Fed and Treasury perspective. And when I look at the quantity of money provided to the system, whether explicitly or implicitly by the Federal Reserve over the last, let's say, since 2007, it becomes obvious that there are such big holes in the financial system, mm-hmm. that only the central bank is able to put bandages on.
Yeah.
And in that way, we have to explain Bitcoin in the context of the current financial system, which is a fractional reserve system that has broken in several places from 2007 to 2020 and has been bandaged by the Federal Reserve in all these places. And it only guarantees more monetary stimulus from the Fed as the economy goes through its business cycle, which is part of my, research as well.
Now, this week, China and Brazil decided to work around the U.S. dollar. So a lot of the shakiness of the U.S. dollar that you base your argument on is happening. We see similar agreements with Russia, Argentina, France, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia. So in giving us the history of currency and then the history of the US dollar, you show us why this is such a shaky place to sort of stake our claims. So do you agree that right now the US dollar is kind of, for lack of a better expression, circling the drain and making the case that we need an alternate currency?
Not necessarily. So I believe that the US dollar and the Federal Reserve's position and the US fiscal position, all of these impact the trustworthiness of the dollar on the global scale. That is undeniable. We can see China, Russia, other countries that have made serious efforts toward going away from the dollar in terms of its dependency. Now, with that being said, the dollar in terms of its usage in global trade and its position in debt capital markets, as well as asset management, which is wealth storage, the dollar is the primary tool, and it's actually by several miles the leader on that front. And then take it one step further, what would be or what could be the challenger to the dollar on that front? I'm talking about true international settlement, global capital markets, and the denomination of the balance sheets of corporations around the world, and you know, the debt and debt and equity that they issue. There, if you look to China and you look to Europe, and you know, Russia doesn't even have an international currency. Europe does, and China doesn't have an internationalized currency, but they're making certain efforts. So between China and between the EU, neither one of them has a currency that is even remotely positioned to challenge the dollar on a global capital market basis. So I want to establish that. But then if you take it one step further, we're talking about Bitcoin. The Bitcoin benefits from the concept that all of the central banks and all of the countries around the world are competing with each other. And so in that global race to the bottom, you're saying circling the drain of the dollar. It's not only the dollar, though. It's all of the central bank currencies
Right. Currently
have no ability to sustain themselves in their current form, so they have to devalue against each other over time. And so, but in that relationship, I still do believe the dollar remains dominant for many, many years to come, and that the talk of China establishing international relationships over the yuan is slightly overblown and has been in the news really constantly since the year 2010, when the financial crisis was really starting to just slow down a little bit. Then you saw China start to make these announcements that we're going to go away from the dollar. Well, it's 13, 14 years later, and we still haven't seen any true internationalization or China opening its capital account, meaning that you can't actually settle yuan around the world. It's not possible without permission of the Chinese government. So we are still miles away from the dollar being challenged by other government currencies.
Okay. So what you're saying then is it's not just the dollar, it's all fiat currencies. And you present here this idea of king dollar. You say, amidst the global currency war, the dollar emerged as the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry of global currencies. You say that the pound sterling abandoned a gold standard in 1931 and officially ended its reign as world reserve currency. So that void was filled by the United States, but it's still sort of just one side of the same coin of fiat currencies. Is that a more accurate description?
Well, if you think about when the U.S. took over from the British pound sterling as the world reserve currency. This happened over several decades between, call it, the late 1800s and 1930s. But by 1970s, the US had abandoned the gold standard itself. And so the US dollar has stood on its own ground, meaning the source of the value of the dollar comes from a combination of trust, military prowess, property rights, et cetera, all the things that make the United States the United States, that is what the dollar stands upon. So if you compare military prowess and you compare the internationalization of the currency, the trust in the rule of law, and relate it to other nations, not just in general, but relate it to other nations, you can see why the dollar might have a very long runway. Because if you compare property rights in the United States and China, what result is that going to spit out to you as an analyst when making the decision between these two currencies over a multi-decade time frame?
Right.
It's not easy to see China taking over the role of a global reserve currency from the United States, given what we know, because China isn't going suddenly to some commodity-backed currency that is going to attract demand and sustain value versus other things that might decline as fiat currencies devalue. So if that becomes the case, it's a different conversation. But as I see it right now, it's just not the case that China can really take that international currency role away from the dollar.
Now, what can we learn from the recent bailouts of the banking sector? You write that the Fed uses wholesale money and people use retail money. So the Fed was able to bail out banks with a different layer of money. How is that now going to affect us all? Because I heard you on the Tom Wheelwright podcast talking about how we didn't actually feel the full effects of the 2008 crisis. And so does this bailout mean we will feel it? And how will this affect all of us?
Well, if you think about the way that the Federal Reserve issues money to cover losses in the financial system, and it always teams up with the Treasury, right? Because the Treasury is the entity that has to support the FDIC, which has to support the banks in times of crisis. And then the Federal Reserve comes in and has their own facilities to backstop the system and guarantee liquidity to the system. So what we saw, despite seeing one new liquidity facility from the Fed, this BTFP facility, besides that, we saw nothing new. And so all we saw is another attempt to paper over the fractional reserve nature of the system by guaranteeing additional FDIC deposits beyond that $250,000 level. And that moving it from $250,000 to the theoretical infinity, or let's just say multi-millions, that move from 250 to, let's say, 10 million is nothing different than the move from 100 to 250 during the 2008 crisis. And it's no different from moving it from, you know, it was originally between $3,000 and $5,000 when it came about in the 1930s. And so the increase of the amount of the federal deposit insurance backstop is in actuality nothing new. And what can we expect as Americans or as participants in the US dollar from this? Nothing new. We are in a global currency war that has been in effect for a decade and a half. Yeah. It is a rotation between easing of around the world, right? We've been in a tightening situation here in the US for the last year plus, but that's because we've had this, you know, inflation episode that the Fed had to address. But once that fades, we'll be back into this devaluation rotation that we've been in for quite a long time.
And so the solution that you see then is a cryptocurrency such as Bitcoin, specifically Bitcoin, because you present this idea of layered currency as if, you know, there was one-time coins and then there's gold and then there's paper money and then there's, you know, numbers in a computer that we agree is money. But you think that this can be flipped. Can you explain this pyramid of a different layer of money in which Bitcoin is the dominant layer? I don't know if dominant's the right word, the top layer.
Sure. So Bitcoin is not issued by a country nor a company. It doesn't have any counterparty risk. It's actually a digital commodity. And in that way, we can compare it to gold historically, in that gold is a commodity. It doesn't have any counterparty risk. Nobody owes you the gold coin that's in your pocket. And in a similar way, if you have custody of Bitcoin private keys that you know, give you signing rights to a balance on this ledger, you have money in your on your person, and that money is not, it's not owed to you, and it exists in ledger form on all the Bitcoin nodes around the world, and that's thousands of computers that keep this record. So there's no one server or one place that you could even bomb to shut this network down and this proof of ownership network. And in that way, Bitcoin has established itself as the preeminent and the dominant digital commodity in the world. And that digital commodity, I do view, will be used as a store of value to escape this competitive devaluation nature of fiat currencies. But it doesn't mean it will replace it and become the rails for all financial transactions over any medium-term time horizon. However, I do see Bitcoin taking a role of digital gold, being a store of value that people are able to keep outside of the current global state-issued currency or even bank-issued currency system that we use today.
You write that Bitcoin thrives amidst instability, and we see that happening this week. Bitcoin is hitting highs for the year as, you know, people are kind of scrambling about our economy and this exactly right now. And so is this what you would have expected Bitcoin to do amidst the geopolitical system?
It's a good question. And to be very honest with you, Bitcoin and its price behavior, it's such a volatile asset that it's almost difficult to judge any few weeks of price action based off of the news. Mm. Because what we saw last year is an incredibly strong correlation between Bitcoin and the stock market. And as rates rose, we had risk assets fall in price as, you know, the discount rate increases, the present value of cash flows decrease. And we saw that happen to stocks, and we saw Bitcoin fall in sympathy. But it's not even in sympathy, it's because it's owned at the portfolio level by the same people that own stocks. And so they do trade as correlated assets. With that being said, Bitcoin has responded nicely to a banking crisis, for sure, and it has outperformed the S&P by a significant margin during the last couple weeks, really, since the Silicon Valley demise. But in that way, interest rates have also come down over that time horizon, which is, in theory, should be supportive to Bitcoin, as we saw, you know, that correlation last year. When rates rose, Bitcoin fell. This year, rates are falling and Bitcoin is rising. So it's really hard to pinpoint the why. Rather, I like to look at Bitcoin's 200-week moving average, which is like a four-year average price of Bitcoin. It's in a steady state of increase and has been since that average came about 4 years after Bitcoin's price history. So we see Bitcoin steadily increasing in price, and I do believe that that will continue.
Interesting. All right. Well, thank you so much. And I appreciate that you're unwilling to speak in hyperbole. Like I said, I've learned a lot from your book. I appreciate it a lot. And I want to recommend it again. So you can follow Nick Bhatia on Twitter at Time Value of BTC. You can seek out the book as well. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us before we let you go?
Sure. People can find all my work right now at thebitcoinlayer.com. We have a free newsletter and we have a YouTube channel, which is also free. So a lot of content for people to check out. We analyze Bitcoin through a global macro lens.
Okay. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you.
All right. We've got more news to get to here on your Thursday. We're going to be talking with investigative journalist Whitney Webb around this Jeffrey Epstein, Jamie Dimon connection. You don't want to miss this. I'm crazy. She just wrote a new piece about the rise of Jamie Dimon, but this new lawsuit is going to force him to testify. What will we learn about Jeffrey Epstein? And what will we learn about the broader global financial system right now? Because he's actively involved from the very beginning of this total collapse that we're seeing since the 1970s. And we're also going to look at the latest in Israel. And was the United States meddling in Israel? and actually meddling in those protests. Also, Dr. Asim Malhotra is going to be joining us because there's a bombshell new lawsuit against Pfizer. So Dr. Asim is going to be here as well on the show. He's giving a speech in Gibraltar soon, I think tonight. I'm not sure what time. Might be about to happen. I don't know. Anyway, he's about to give a speech on adverse events in Spain. And so we're going to talk to him about this, what's the craziness in South Africa with this lawsuit. So we're going to get there in a second. But first, the value of the U.S. dollar is in full decline. And if you're relying on a 401k or an IRA for your retirement, you are in for a world of hurt. What if you could invest in real estate that produces monthly cash flow, is a hedge against inflation, is a tax write-off, a tax shelter, arguably the best tax shelter in the United States, and all of it is 100% done for you? Well, meaning you don't have to hire contractors, hire property managers, or any of that. That's where Morris Invest comes in. And yes, it's our company. Our team is building about 500 homes this year in Texas and Missouri. We've got an amazing team. These are brand new construction properties built from the ground up. So our company is the number one full service rental real estate company in the United States. No one even comes close to what we're able to provide. You could invest in brand new construction real estate in the best rental markets in the country. We're talking West Texas. We're talking Joplin, Missouri, and it's fully done for you. We have financing built into the properties. We work with over 100 different lenders. Right now, we have about 23 homes left for sale. They are first come, first serve. So if any of you are like high-level investors, you are really interested in real estate investing, maybe you have some old investments you want to roll over using a 1031 exchange. That's a bit of a ninja, more advanced move. But if you are an advanced investor, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you want an incredible tax write-off and you want full-service investing and with a team that can help you right from the moment you get on the phone, book a call with our team. All you need to do is the website is right there on the screen. Just go to redacted.inc/invest. Redacted.inc/invest. Again, that's redacted.inc/invest. Well, the tentacles of Jeffrey Epstein go wide and they go deep, and they reach right into Jamie Dimon, who is the J.P. Morgan chief executive. Jamie Dimon, he's going to be interviewed under oath now in these Jeffrey Epstein lawsuits. Investigative journalist Whitney Webb has been covering this story from the very beginning. She's written a great new piece called The Rise of Jamie Dimon on her website, unlimitedhangout.com. I encourage all of you to read it. So, what is this connection, this Jeffrey Epstein connection, and how big and wide does this go beyond Jeffrey Epstein? Investigative journalist Whitney Webb joins us now. Welcome back to the show. Whitney, great to see you.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me back on.
My pleasure. And you've written, so first of all, I just want to start there at the beginning, sort of about Jamie Dimon, and then we can get into the broader implications of this and how wide this goes. Jamie Dimon going to be interviewed in Jeffrey Epstein lawsuits, and a lot of people hoping that we'll learn a lot more about this relationship and Jeffrey Epstein and these deeper connections here. So first, for our viewers who don't understand or have any idea why Jamie Dimon would be involved in this, who is Jamie Dimon and how is he involved with Jeffrey Epstein?
Okay, so for people that don't know, Jamie Dimon is the CEO, and he has been since the early 2000s, of JP Morgan Chase, one of the biggest banks on Wall Street. And he's considered one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, Wall Street banker today. And he's currently in the news in relation to the Epstein case because there is a lawsuit being brought from the U.S. Virgin Islands, which argues that Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking activity was directly enabled by Jeffrey Epstein, particularly by two J.P. Morgan executives. The main focus of the case being Jess Stahli, who left the bank in around 2013. But they've alleged that lawyers for the USVI have alleged that Jamie Dimon himself was aware of the situation and directly enabled Epstein, and the JP Morgan Chase has denied this and is trying to make Stahli, you know, essentially the scapegoat for the whole case and trying to keep Dimon away from it. But Dimon is going to be forced to offer a statement or potentially be interviewed under oath. So it remains to be seen what's going on there and how deep those questions will go. Obviously, the U.S. Virgin Islands is making a very praiseworthy effort to hold this particular bank to account. And let's keep in mind that a few days after this this exact lawsuit was filed, the Attorney General of the U.S. Virgin Islands, Denise George, was fired. And so a lot of people see a connection between that firing and her filing of this particular lawsuit, which has been allowed to advance in U.S. courts, despite JP Morgan and Chase trying to prevent that from happening. So, hasn't been said, right?
I just want to ask you. So we'll get to the what hasn't been said part. But just to be clear, you say that JP Morgan Chase was enabling this sex trafficking by Epstein. That's what the lawsuit alleges. Can you be specific? How were they enabling that?
So someone that was actually at the hearing sent me a leaked recording of it, and there was a lot that happened there that did not make it into mainstream press reports. One of them being that it was very clear from JP Morgan internal reports that Jeffrey Epstein allegedly was having a financial advisory firm at the time, but his accounts at JP Morgan reflect no activity that would have potentially involved any sort of clients. It was very odd financial activity, and he was making payments to known victims of his sex trafficking scheme, and he was using JP Morgan to give significant loans to Jean-Luc Brunel's MC2 business. And Jean-Luc Brunel, of course, is a major part of the Epstein case, particularly as it relates to the sex trafficking activities. And he, of course, was arrested in Paris and died under the same circumstances as Epstein did, in a jail cell in what was ruled a suicide, but is very unlikely to actually have been the case. And JP Morgan is alleged to have directly facilitated that, because given their own internal admissions about the oddities of the report, the oddities of Epstein's account, something should have been done long ago and nothing was done. And they allege, the USVI say that they'll be providing documents that show that this went far beyond just Stali and actually go straight to the executive suite, meaning Jamie Dimon.
Wow. So what's not being said? I'm sorry to interrupt you earlier, but I want to know how this enabling process is unbelievable and much, much deeper than I even anticipated.
Yeah, so basically what's not being said is that the reason Jamie Dimon is head of JP Morgan Chase at all really has to do intimately with the circle around Leslie Wexner, particularly his right-hand man, John W. Kessler. So, you know, Leslie Wexner has two hands, and as someone who's researched him a lot, you know, essentially you have on the one hand Kessler and you had on the other hand Epstein. That's how close these particular associates of him were. And Kessler, in addition with a particular family from Chicago that's part of the same network I write about in the book that has a lot of connections to Wexner, the Crown family of Chicago, were essentially the people that orchestrated Jamie Dimon's installment as CEO of Bank One in the year 2000. So the Crown family essentially orchestrated the ouster of the previous CEO, and then Kessler and this sort of Wexner-centric team on the board of Bank One, along with the Crown family and their associates, came together and chose Jamie Dimon to be the CEO of Bank One. And Bank One, a few years later, was acquired by JP Morgan Chase, and Jamie Dimon was put in charge of that. So essentially what my article shows is what Bank One was before that point, and going way, 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 way back, very Wexner-centric, allegedly involved in all sorts of criminal activity, including money laundering, arms deals, and very shady financial connections with Leslie Wexner's The Limited, among other things. And on top of that, if you look at Dimon's history before he became CEO of Bank One, he was building Citigroup with his mentor, Sandy Weill, and that began with a company they acquired in 1985 called Commercial Credit Corporation. And as I note in the article, Commercial Credit Corporation and its parent company, Control Data Corp, are essentially espionage cutouts tied to these networks of intelligence and organized crime that were working together to essentially make money, but also were subverting U.S. National security by engaging in illicit technology transfers. They were spying on the U.S. military, and they were, you know, essentially shipping off a bunch of sensitive U.S. military and other types of technology to the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War, in the same networks that include people like Robert Maxwell and his confidant and lawyer, the father of current U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, Samuel Pisar. And a lot of these people are intimately connected, as I note in the article. A lot of it seemed to have been centered around this particular think tank called the American Committee for U.S.-Soviet Relations, which had a lot of these organized crime figures, people close to the Crown family, like Paul Ziffrin, people close to Robert Maxwell, people like Armand Hammer, whose father was a Soviet spy and tried to buy a bank where a lot of U.S. congressmen had accounts for the purposes of financially blackmailing them. You know, these guys were extremely aggressive in promoting tech transfers to the Soviet Union for the purpose of essentially equalizing the playing field in a sense. But as Samuel Pisar told Congress in the early 70s, it was to create a single unified world economy where you have private Western capitalist enterprises merging their activities with communist state-run enterprises and ostensible adversary nations with the goal of, like, you know, creating a global a single, you know, economic economy. It's very disturbing stuff. And this company that was at the center of that is now Citigroup.
Wow. So a unipolar banking system, a unipolar order run by these unelected people running the world economy. That's basically, yeah, they laid this out in the 1970s.
So PSR essentially said the nation state's becoming irrelevant because it's all about private enterprises in the West merging and intermingling with communist state-run enterprises in Russia and China and elsewhere. And a lot of the major facilitators of this were, you know, people like Robert Maxwell, people like Samuel Pisar, and a lot of these other businessmen in this particular nexus that involve a lot of organized crime and intelligence connections. Because essentially, at the end of the day, they want to be, you know, whoever controls the money controls the world, right? So if you build a single unified world economy, which you uniquely control, then you control everything.
And as you've pointed out in your piece and otherwise, that this is... they've been at the heart of each of these financial collapses, right? They've been there right in the middle of it.
Yeah, a lot of them. Yeah. So, for example, in the 1980s, there was a major crisis with savings and loans, and you had an insane amount of collapses of savings and loans institutions throughout the United States. You had the situation with Michael Milken and the junk bonds, Drexel, Burnham, Lambert. All of these are very much tied to intelligence organized crime connections. I detail a lot of this in my book, but there's, you know, the work of Pete Bruton, formerly of the Houston Post, and a lot of reporting over the decades on that. And essentially what resulted, what came out of that is that, you know, the federal government and the bodies responsible for handling these types of situations would take the collapsed institutions, bundle them together, and sell their assets off to stable financial institutions. And so, you know, an entity like Bake One, which is very close to, you know, Leslie Wexner, was absorbing a lot of these. And a lot of these banks today, these mega banks, these so-called too big to fail banks, just consolidating, consolidating, consolidating. So you have over time, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of banks all over the country in the U.S. And it's slowly becoming fewer and fewer as banks collapse. And a lot of these banks collapse are engineered. And so this particular article I have up right now about the rise of Jamie Dimon is really just part of a series, because I also have evidence that in 2008, that was, you know, the collapse of Bear Stearns. Jeffrey Epstein essentially was the, you know, if you want to see Bear Stearns as a giant bubble, the pin that popped Bear Stearns was Jeffrey Epstein. And then he goes and Bear Stearns gets folded into JP Morgan. And then he starts banking with JP Morgan, and all the stuff at the center of the lawsuit that we talked about earlier, you know, are based in that period. But, you know, it's a big benefit. The 2008, you know, economic crisis, you know, was very beneficial to these big bankers because all the failed banks, they just absorbed and, you know, became bigger and bigger and bigger. And what we're seeing now with the current banking crisis is much of the same. I would argue that you're going to see these banks collapse. A lot of I'm sure as you've covered on your show, a lot of these banks didn't need to be shut down, like Signature Bank. They were only shut down because they were viewed as pro-crypto. The U.S. is having a regulatory crackdown on the crypto industry, and now they're being folded into other mega banks. It's just consolidation, and it's leading us towards this exact plan that was mapped out in the 70s, a one-world economy, essentially.
Unbelievable. Not unbelievable when you see it all coming together like this and the web that you've uncovered here. One of the connections that you write about in this piece is where you point out that J.P. Morgan, their claims are that Jamie Dimon never really knew what Epstein was up to at all during his time. And as you point out, that makes it very difficult to explain given all of these connections. So
yeah,
their stance is they didn't know. He didn't know anything. He's totally absolved of this.
Yeah, well, you know, it's hard to believe because the same people that are responsible for Jeffrey Epstein are responsible for Jamie Dimon being the top Wall Street banker in the country. And that's very significant. And, you know, we'll see if this particular case questions him about people like John W. Kessler, his time at Bank One, and the financial circles around Leslie Wexner, because Leslie Wexner was on the board of that bank for a very long time and was actually at one point holding unclaimed funds for this bank that allegedly the state of Ohio couldn't find Bank One, one of the biggest banks in the state, to return them their unclaimed funds. And Wexner's on the board of the bank, but also can't find Bank One to return their unclaimed funds. And the Limited isn't a bank. It's supposed to be a retail, you know, company. So why are they holding state unclaimed funds? I mean, there's totally a bunch of funny business going on here. And that was in the mid 1990s, not that long before Jamie Dimon took the reins of that particular bank. And as I note in my piece, and I referred to earlier, Bank One was money laundering for Middle East arms sales, including for Iran-Contra. And as I've noted before in my work on the Wexner-Epstein stuff, they were intimately involved in that as well, particularly with their acquisition of the CIA's Air America, or renamed Southern Air Transport in the mid-1990s, ostensibly to run cargo from the Limited between Columbus and Hong Kong. And this is at the time when Epstein is meeting at the White House with people like Mark Middleton, who were central to this Chinagate scandal, which is the same thing about this illicit tech transfers, but instead of the Soviet Union, it was to China. And you have the CIA airline that was involved in all that stuff before at the center of it, but it's very involved, you know, with Wexner's business interests. And Wexner, of course, is very involved in China and has been for a long time. The bulk of his retail industry is based there through his longstanding affiliation from the 70s onward with Mast Industries, which is based in Hong Kong. And he, you know, was lobbying for all sorts of business deals all over the world to benefit China. For example, he was trying to create a joint venture between the Limited and Chinese state-run companies in the Golan Heights in what is currently held by Israel, but is actually Syrian territory. And he was meeting with the highest levels of Israeli intelligence and Israeli state officials to make that happen. Another example of private Western capitalist enterprises merging and creating joint ventures with communist state-run enterprises and this technology transfer stuff going on. Why did he need a CIA airline? Because before they teamed up with Southern Air Transport, they tried to get another CIA airline involved called Aero Air, and that didn't work out. And you know, all these, there's hundreds of airlines in the country, but this is the one they wanted right after Iran-Contra. Mm. I mean, it's very bizarre. And you have top Iran-Contra co-conspirators being involved in securing that deal between Southern Air Transport and the Limited. You know, people like Alan Fears and Richard Secord intimately involved in that. You know, I mean, it's totally crazy. But yeah. I think people really need to understand this history because it's having real effects right now, because we're essentially at the end of the line of this decades-long plan where a network of people tied to intelligence and organized crime have created a transnational web where they've essentially completely had any sort of military advantage the United States has ever had in technology, selling it off to our ostensible adversaries. And at the same time, the politicians in power who themselves, like Joe Biden, have economic ties to these same adversary countries are leading us on a march towards war that, thanks to these efforts over the decades, the U.S. is destined to lose. Yeah. It's madness.
It's absolute madness, and we're absolutely seeing it. We're running out of ammunition. You have Mark Milley admitting that if we go to war, we have no...
We're sending all our money to Ukraine.
Right.
Or have been.
And we don't have the production capacity. We don't have the recruitment capacity, and we're heading right into World War III with these countries, which is insanity. What do you hope that you, as a journalist, what are you hoping would come from this testimony from Jamie Dimon in this Epstein lawsuit? What, is there any specific nugget that if you could ask him a question, you would?
Yeah, ask him about Leslie Wexner and John W. Kessler, because as I noted in my piece, John W. Kessler was intimately involved with all these shady businesses and organized crime connections that resulted that came out of an investigation into the murder in broad daylight of the Limited's tax attorney in 1985. Very involved in very corrupt dealings. And there's a lot of very disturbing financial activity that was taking place at Bank One throughout Kessler's time. And the people that are responsible for Diamond being there is the organized crime connected Crown family, which, among other things, controls a U.S. weapons manufacturer, General Dynamics. And then Kessler and the Wexner orbit, you know, he's essentially there. Why are the same people that put him in charge of J.P. Morgan the same people behind Jeffrey Epstein? And, you know, how would he not have known who Epstein was because of those connections? It seems very difficult to believe that there wouldn't be any sort of connection there, or that Jamie Dimon would have no idea who Epstein was and what was going on. It just doesn't really seem very credible. And I doubt he'll be asked about this deeper background to it. You know, we'll see exactly how far the U.S. Virgin Islands is willing to go.
Yeah, to really push this question. I hope that they'll get deep on this and not, you know, be given one or two word answers and then move on to the next question. Whitney Webb, I encourage all of you to read her latest piece on her website, unlimitedhangout.com. It's called The Rise of Jamie Dimon. If you want a deeper understanding of all of this and these connections, start there. Read also her two great books as well on Jeffrey Epstein and the Deep State Mafia, which is leading us into World War III right now and absolute destruction. Whitney, great to see you. Thank you so much for joining us here on the show, as always.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Really great. Right. I mean, just swallowing all out, people like in the chat, I love her, as I glance over, people like, man, she is really sharp.
Yeah. Yes.
Very smart.
Yeah.
So
amazing. All right. Well, we have more to get to. But first, we want to tell you a little bit about our redacted store. In the beginning of the show, we showed you a viewer who's wearing our Silence Equals Complicity shirt. That sale ends tonight if you'd like that limited time shirt. And it will look just as foxy on you as it does on these models, I'm sure, and all of our viewers. But we have more than shirts there. We have mugs. We have hoodies. We have different hats and things like that. And you can show your support for independent journalism and your support of this show and maybe help raise awareness about this place of free speech and free thought. And we really appreciate you doing so. So head on over to redactedstore.com, get your merch and support our free thinking and independent journalism. Once again, it's redactedstore.com. Head on over there and check it out. Redactedstore.com.
Are we seeing a color revolution in, of all places, Israel? That's right. Well, the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's son has directly now accused the Biden administration of meddling, being behind the scenes of the mass protests against the judicial process and the judicial reform that his country and his government have been pushing. The Biden administration meddling in other countries? No, it can't be. Dan Cohen, Washington correspondent for Redacted, who's covered Israel for many, many years, is here with the latest on this. So, Dan, meddling from the Biden administration in Israel? Wow.
Well, it's pretty remarkable to see this happening in, you know, what is ostensibly the U.S.'s top ally in maybe the world, at least the Middle East. And really, I think, is a story about the U.S. trying to maintain what it calls the special relationship with Israel and keep a certain political element in power in Israel. So I want to give our viewers some background so they can understand this story. So in January, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu comes to power again, and this time with the most extreme right-wing coalition that Israel has ever seen, including his public security minister, a guy named Itamar Ben-Gvir, who we've spoken about before. He is what they call a Kahanist, a follower of the late Rabbi Meir Kahana, who's basically, they have the ideology of like ISIS, but Israeli, Jewish style. So that is the element that Netanyahu is kind of made common cause with in order to get into power. And that political sector wants to get rid of the Supreme Court in Israel. The right in Israel essentially wants to get rid of the Supreme Court because it views it as holding back its agenda. And Netanyahu has agreed to carry out a series of, to pass a series of laws that would weaken the Supreme Court and put more power in the legislature, in Netanyahu's coalition. So this, since January, there have been massive protests against this judicial reform, judicial overhaul. And it got to a point where earlier this month, the Biden administration, specifically Biden, put out a statement calling for some kind of compromise between the protesters and the Netanyahu government and saying that these judicial reforms are fundamentally anti-democratic. That sort of fell on deaf ears. The protests grew, and Biden put out an even stronger statement that coincided with the largest protests they've seen. This was on March 28th. Take a listen to what Biden said.
Like many strong supporters of Israel, I'm very concerned. And I'm concerned that they get this straight. They cannot continue on this road. And I've sort of made that clear. Hopefully, the Prime Minister will act in a way that he can try to work out some genuine compromise, but that remains to be seen.
So at that point, after that statement from Biden and these enormous protests and the threat of a general strike, Netanyahu put the judicial overhaul on hold, said, okay, we're going to table this and work something out. But at the same time, he sent out a message on Twitter taking a shot at Biden, and he said, Israel is a sovereign country which makes its decisions by the will of its people and not based on pressures from abroad, including the best of friends. So Netanyahu throwing some shade at Biden there. And remember, Netanyahu was caught years before in the early 2000s saying he is the most qualified Israeli politician to be the prime minister because he is so skilled, adept at manipulating the United States. And so he thinks that the United States should be subservient to Israel, where, of course, you know, the United States wants Israel to serve its interests, which is why it pours so much money into Israel every year, $3.8 billion. So Netanyahu's statement was followed by another from Itamar Ben-Gvir, the public security minister, where he says, we are not another star on the American flag. So again, pushing back against the Biden administration from these top Israeli officials. So when Netanyahu put this judicial overhaul on hold, he had to give something to his coalition, to the most right-wing members of his party. So what he agreed to is the creation of what they're calling a National Guard that is overseen by Itamar Ben-Gvir. Now, Ben-Gvir, again, he's one of the most extreme figures in Israeli society, wants to expel every last Palestinian, get rid of churches, get rid of mosques, and have only Jews in Israel. That is the ideology that he promotes. So his movement has tons of young, you know, what you could compare to hooligans who go out in the streets and beat Palestinians. Most famously, they rampaged through cities where there are Palestinian populations in May of 2021 during the Israeli war on Gaza. They dragged a Palestinian from his car and beat him within a breath of his life. And that was actually broadcast on national television. Similarly, those mobs just a couple of nights ago tried to lynch a Palestinian taxi driver. So it's these kinds of mobs that will be formalized into a National Guard. That is Netanyahu's giveaway, his compromise with his backers. So the big question about U.S. involvement in these protests, well, the Israeli right, as you said, Clayton, including Benjamin Netanyahu's son, Yair, have accused the U.S., the Biden administration, of orchestrating a color revolution, and there appears to be some real truth to that. A group at the center of these protests is called the Movement for Quality Government, and it is funded in part by the U.S. State Department. It's not a huge amount of money, but it does show that there is foreign involvement from the United States and that it shows where the U.S. government stands. There's also a clip going around on pro-Netanyahu, pro-judicial reform Twitter of Prime Minister, former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who's from a sort of more liberal wing of Israeli politics, closely tied with the Clintons, was a guest of Jeffrey Epstein, so kind of that milieu. And he says that Netanyahu is actually carrying out a regime change in Israel using the tools of democracy, and that the protesters are the counter-revolution. Listen to this.
So it's a clash. These top-down regime change using the tools, the legal tools of democracy, facing a counter-revolution from bottom up. And we will win. I'm confident of it. Because I know our people, and we have even empirical evidence for this.
So Ehud Barak, again, says that Netanyahu and his ilk are using the tools of democracy to impose this regime change, to get rid, essentially weaken the Supreme Court, and that that necessitates this kind of foreign-funded, he doesn't admit it, but upswell, that he uses the 3.5% language, that you have to get 3.5%, which is basically taken directly from the ideas of Gene Sharp, who is the father of color revolutions. He came up with the whole idea of how the U.S. would carry out color revolutions in Eastern Europe after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and he is, his kind of ideology, his ideas about how nonviolent protest can be used to overthrow governments have been incredibly successful and used by the U.S. all over the world, and now it appears that's what's being used in Israel. So there's another layer I want to talk about here, another sort of layer of complexity. The fact that American oligarchs have also funded Netanyahu and the settler movement, the hard right movement that he's kind of in bed with. But the difference, I think the key thing here is that the United States on one hand and these American oligarchs want to fund those groups to kind of carry out the project in Israel, to go build settlements, to get rid of Palestinians from Jerusalem. They don't want them to take ultimate power, to be in the sort of the top of the heap of the political spectrum, because the special relationship between Israel and the United States relies on the image that Israel is a democracy, and that therefore we must support it because it's in this tough neighborhood surrounded by enemies. And in order to maintain that, well, you can't weaken the Supreme Court and have huge masses of liberals coming out to protest against the government. So I think that's why the U.S. is fundamentally getting involved here, to kind of keep the most hard right elements on the margins a little bit, not be able to have total power in Israel.
Well, given the accusations of a color revolution, regime change, that's what this is. What is the geopolitical angle here that the Israelis are accusing the Biden administration of? They want the Netanyahu government dissolved, gone, him out of power. Is that the ultimate goal?
I think the U.S. government is perfectly happy with Netanyahu as long as he stays within certain confines, and bringing these super overtly extreme elements into power who fundamentally don't have that, you know, it's a very small amount of difference in policy. I mean, they want regular wars on Gaza. They want to, you know, completely demolish it, just like the liberals do. I mean, Ehud Barak oversaw horrible wars against Palestinians and oversaw the occupation. But the key thing I think to understand here is that the U.S. wants to maintain Israel for its own benefit. So, meaning a weapon against Iran and a weapon against Hezbollah in Lebanon, especially as the U.S. is kind of losing its influence throughout the region as China is stepping in, working out diplomatic deals between Iran and Saudi Arabia, between Syria and the UAE. So where the U.S. is, where China is putting out fires, the U.S. sees, wait a minute, we can't, you know, have Israel kind of, you know, go off the rails. We need it to maintain this image so we can continue to support it and keep our influence in the region, in especially as the threat, you know, as the likelihood of a war against Iran increases, which there's not a lot of daylight between Netanyahu and the Biden administration on that.
Well, of course, the United States funnels billions of dollars to Israel on a regular basis in the form of weapons and aid on a regular basis. So it, of course, it would make sense that Israel should be doing their bidding, right? That's kind of the relationship, it seems. Like, we give you this money, we give you these weapons, and then you follow, you fall in line with what we want, are driving our Middle East policy. You are the tip of the spear. You're the cudgel for us in the Middle East, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, that money obviously comes with strings attached. So when in moments like this, there's some kind of daylight and that the U.S. sees there is a threat to the special relationship, that the sort of order in Israel that you have, you know, more liberal elements running the show and the kind of hard right wing elements kind of more on the periphery, then it's time to, you know, have some kind of intervention.
Well, we'll see what happens with this government. We'll see what this judicial reform looks like, if it's on hold or if it moves forward. Dan Cohen, who's been covering Israel for us, thank you so much. We really appreciate it, Dan.
Thanks, Clayton.
And we've got more news to get to here on your Thursday. We're going to be joined by Dr. Asim Malorta, who is going to be looking at what's this bombshell Pfizer story that no one else is covering. We have an exclusive discussion with the Dr. Asim on this story, this bombshell Pfizer lawsuit in South Africa, where Pfizer will have to testify. And what will we learn from this? We're going to speak to the good doctor in just a moment. But in order to do that, we're going to have to move over to Rumble, because there are things we're going to be talking about as it relates to these vaccines that we are not comfortable talking about right here on this platform because of our past banning and blocking and censorship that we've received here on YouTube, where we've been blocked and banned 4 different times for covering Pfizer. So we will move over to Rumble for that segment with Dr. Asim. So come on over to our Rumble channel right now, which is rumble.com/redacted. Rumble.com/redacted. Our stream will continue unfettered, uncensored over on Rumble. So all of you who are watching on YouTube, come on over. It's nice and warm over there on Rumble. There's 15,000 of you right now on YouTube.
It's easy. Just click it.
Yeah, just come on over and join us, because, you know, this is a platform that does not abide censorship, and they are very pro-free speech. So come on over and join us. Again, rumble.com/redacted. Bye, everyone on YouTube. Welcome to all of you on Rumble. Good to see all of you tonight. Nice to see all of you. We're going to get to that story in just a moment. These are some crazy, stressful times that we're dealing with. I saw someone earlier saying, I need some CBD right now. I think we were doing it during the Whitney Webb story. They're like, I need to relax. I need to get rid of that stress. So what is your solution to relax? If you haven't tried CBD, you haven't experienced complete relaxation. CBDDistillery.com has the best CBD products, including their top-rated Synergy Plus collection. No prescription needed. It's delivered right to your door. You don't need a prescription. But this delivers a sense of calmness and well-being. It'll make you wonder how you manage to live life without it. So what could possibly be this effective at taking the edge off of life and deliver a level of chill that you've never experienced? It's called their Unwind Synergy, plus THC and CBD. It's only available from CBDistillery.com. You must be 21 years old or older. Unwind Synergy is remarkably formulated with full-spectrum CBD plus hemp-derived Delta-9 THC. Bottom line, if you could use a little peace and calm in your life, Unwind Synergy is for you. Give it a shot right now. You're going to get 20% off. 20% off just by going to CBDistillery.com and use that code redacted. Put in the word redacted. You get 20% off. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, and South Dakota. Once again, CBDistillery.com. Well, to a bombshell story now out of South Africa, and the mainstream media, of course, mostly ignoring this story, but we are not. And these words, unsafe and ineffective, those are the words being used to describe Pfizer's mRNA COVID vaccine as part of a new landmark case that is being brought in the High Court of South Africa against Pfizer, specifically demanding that these drugs be stopped immediately, the complete cessation of these drugs. Someone who's been leading the fight to get these drugs stopped immediately is cardiologist Dr. Asim Mayorta, and he joins us now from Gibraltar, Spain, where you're actually speaking on vaccine injuries there in Gibraltar as well. Doctor, good to see you. Welcome back to the show.
Great to see you again, Clayton.
So what does this case mean? I mean, this is the first of its kind that I'm aware of, and this literally could set the stage for future lawsuits brought against Pfizer around the world.
Yeah, Clayton, absolutely. So let me just make it very specific and clarify what the case is about. So the Freedom Alliance of South Africa, which is a grassroots movement, which has international supporters made up of doctors, lawyers, media, parents, activists, have actually brought a case to the High Court of Pretoria in South Africa, calling for specifically a judicial review of Pfizer's product, stating that the evidence with leading international scientists have contributed with affidavits suggests that the vaccine, Pfizer's COVID vaccine, is not safe and not effective, and want that judicial review to take place. What that means is if it is successful, then it will result in Pfizer's product being removed from the market. And what they've said is that really the medical regulator in South Africa did not do its duty, really, ultimately. The suggestion is that they approved this vaccine on the basis of irrationality, because the data that was used to make these decisions, and of course, we know this internationally, was based upon Pfizer's own data, which was commercially conflicted. They designed the analysis. We now know, the suggestion is there was manipulations of the data. From real world evidence, we know that now. Certainly there's a suggestion of that, Clayton, because they told us at the beginning it was 95% effective in preventing infection. That very quickly turned out not to be true. So that's what really is, what this case is about. And I think what's also really important to emphasize is that, of course, there's been a real problem getting this discussion and getting both sides of the story into the mainstream media. That will not be an issue in a court of law. In a court of law, all sides will get an airing. All the evidence will be heard. And I think it's really important because you and I know, when you look at the totality of the evidence, it's a very different picture to what we were told at the beginning, that this was safe and effective. And certainly my own conclusions, independently of, even of this case, Clayton, I have been calling for, based upon my peer-reviewed critical analysis and research, for a complete suspension of this product, because the evidence suggests that the harms are considerable and the benefits are certainly now close to negligible. And, I think this is a really important moment that this is happening, because it will go to court likely in the next few months. And we'll see how it plays out. And of course, this will be open to the public. It'll be open to the media. It may be televised. So I think it has massive, massive international implications. And you've already alluded to the fact that South Africa itself is a country which has been involved in many historical revolutions for truth and justice. I was there for a few weeks and on a speaking tour, and I hadn't even occurred to me that Mahatma Gandhi started his movement in South Africa. He was actually first jailed in Johannesburg, and I visited the jail where both he and Mandela were first imprisoned. So I think, there's some historical precedent there.
Let's talk about the specifics of what the international body would find in a court proceeding, right? Because we've had investigative journalist Sonia Elijah here on the show multiple times detailing the irregularities in the blot tests and the faking, it looks like, of these of the lab results in order to bring these vaccines to market, like copying and pasting blot test results in order to fake this. So what specifically would this international group of scientists, doctors who are pushing for this review, what evidence do you think they would bring before the judge?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of that evidence, actually. It will be subject to, public will be able to see it pretty quickly, actually. But it's hundreds of pages and many, many, well over a dozen international scientists that have given their own views on what the harms are showing from the vaccine, from anything from, sudden cardiac death, neurological complications, fetal abnormalities. So that's the evidence that they've put forward. But just to give you some key points, if you look at the original trial, what's interesting to note is that, when we talk about the benefits of any drug, in a clinical trial, we use a term called efficacy that in a clinical trial, what were the benefits? And that's efficacy, not effectiveness. Effectiveness actually is what happens in the real world. And there are huge discrepancies between the type of people that were chosen in the trial that led to the approval of the vaccine, Clayton's. For example, they traditionally, what the drug companies do is they design the trials, pick the lowest risk group of patients that are likely to get side effects. And then it's then presumed that the benefits and the harms are going to be replicated in the real world, when often it isn't the case because they have chosen the lowest of this risk group. But even despite that, and a reanalysis published in the journal Vaccine last year, peer-reviewed journal, highest impact journal for vaccines, revealed that a reanalysis of the original trial in the so-called healthier group that were tested, this vaccine was tested on, still showed more risk of serious adverse events from the vaccine than people being hospitalized with COVID. So from the beginning, it didn't look good. So all these sorts of things are going to be teased out, including there's another interesting issue that many people may not be familiar with, is that the benefits of the vaccine were only deemed to occur after they'd had two doses. So if people got COVID in between the first and second dose, that wasn't counted, even though in the trial, there was a suggestion that many people suffered symptoms of COVID having had the first dose, but it wasn't tested for. So all of these things are going to be scrutinized properly in a court of law with various experts. And Pfizer clearly have a case to answer. You know, they will be called, they will be summoned for sure, and they will have to answer the case. And of course, we then have so much data from the real world, from VAERS in the US, yellow card scheme, what's actually happening. And there's a huge disconnect, Clayton, as well. You know, separate to the case, of course, one of the most interesting publications, which we hadn't discussed on your show, which only came out a couple of months ago, was published in BMC Infectious Diseases. And that was a survey of people in the United States. And what they found, and okay, one can argue it's low quality evidence, but it's still important because in medicine, we are taught that 80% of your diagnosis comes from the history. That means a discussion with the patient. If you listen to your patient, more often than not, you will get the diagnosis. So you can kind of apply that rule to this sort of publication. And it's quite extraordinary. What they found in this publication is that there may be as many as 1 million serious adverse events that happened in 2021 because of the COVID vaccines in the US, okay? And 278,000 fatalities. Now, this is because they talked to people and they said, do you know someone that suffered a serious adverse event, or did you suffer one, or someone that may have died, where it was felt, where the patient or the members of the family felt this was caused by the vaccine? Now, this can't be definitive, but it's a huge signal, Clayton, isn't there? There's right. A big disconnect between what the public now think and what the establishment are telling us, because ultimately the truth is coming out. It's, you know, and it's something that we need to be acting upon. And in my view, you know, separate to the specifics of this case, you know, the evidence is overwhelming. This vaccine should have been suspended and withdrawn or pulled a long time ago. And in fact, one of the things that the case is going to try and highlight is that the system actually is not designed in the way that it should be, in the sense that why are regulators, you know, making decisions on Pfizer's own analysis, not independent researchers looking at it? Because that should have happened from the beginning. And if it did, Clayton, it's likely this vaccine would never have been approved in the first place. So what we need to also think moving forward, hopefully with this case as well, depending on the outcome, is that we need to, you know, dissociate regulators from getting money from industry, right? They're getting money from the very industries they're trying to, you know, approve their drugs on, but also making sure that the analysis and even the design of these trials, you know, drug companies can develop drugs or products, but that should be done by independent researchers. And I think any sensible person, if you speak to them, you know, in a democratic society, would agree with that. And I'm very much somebody that's for real democracy, for informed consent.
Yes, and making sure that we have all the information, not keeping the information hidden. I'll get you out of here on this. These last two questions here, we'll kind of double them up here, doctor, which is, do you think Pfizer is going to be able to weasel themselves out of these court proceedings? And number two, what do you hope we will find during these proceedings? What's your ultimate hope?
Yeah. Great question. So I think, you know, Pfizer obviously will have to answer the questions. I think they'll be very difficult for them to avoid. And of course, if they do avoid, then it doesn't look good on them, right? Because they then aren't presenting a case against all the facts that are being put towards them or against them. In terms of what, it's a really good, the second part of your question is really important. I think what it will do is it will expose in a court of law, in a precise way, in an evidence-based way, all of the structural failures, Clayton, that have been really allowed this situation to occur in the first place, things that have been going on for years. You know, the whole issue of regulatory capture, the issue of the uncontrolled, if you like, both visible and invisible power of these big, powerful corporations over the over politicians, over the media. Because, of course, you know, when the totality of evidence is presented, it's going to look very different to what people were being told from what they read in newspapers. So it's going to show, it's going to expose the big shortcomings of the media as well. And I think that's a good thing, because we want a media that's going to be objective and to give us all the information for us to make decisions on. So I think lots of things are going to come out. And also the other thing is going to highlight the importance of medical ethics, about informed consent, about what information should we be telling patients when it comes to any drug, the absolute benefits and absolute harm, something I've advocated on for many, many years. So I think this has the potential to be game-changing in a positive way for the world and for humanity.
Dr. Asim Ayotra is in Spain right now speaking about adverse events, taking some time out as this landmark case unfolds. We want to thank you for speaking with us and fighting the good fight, continuing to do this work. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Clayton. Just one more thing. I just want to also give a heads up to the mentioning the lead advocate in Britain, we call barrister, on this case, who's really been working very hard on this for many, many months and really putting it all together. And that's Erin Richards.
Yeah, we're working on getting her here on the show. So really excited about that as well, and really dive deeper into this case as it unfolds in South Africa, something we'll be watching very closely. We hope that the mainstream media now will start paying attention to it a little bit more. Doctor, great to see you. Thanks so much for taking some time.
Thank you, Clayton.
All right. And thanks so much, Doctor. We really appreciate it. And thanks to all of you for watching tonight. We really appreciate it. We are taking the week off next week for a little spring break with the family. So we will not have a live show next week. We will be back the following week, but we're going to spend a little time with the kids while they're off of school. I guess it's spring break around the world. So anyway, we're going to take a little downtime, a little R&R, get some books read and hang out with the family and do a little sleeping in if we can.
It's spring break. Woohoo.
Finally. We're going to Senior Frogs in Cancun with the family. No, we won't be doing body shots or anything crazy like that. But we will have content here on the channel, interviews and content while we are gone. We will have some different interviews that we've been holding back that we just did. We want to release to you as well. So please subscribe. Make sure you're subscribed and turn on that bell notification. We really appreciate you joining us tonight. And again, we'll be back a week from Monday.
That's the 10th.
The 10th.
That's right. So please like and subscribe to the show. Please search around for some of the videos that we have, the content that we'll have for the next week. Share it with your friends and interact with us on Twitter if you'd like, because I have been known to get on Twitter while on vacation.
Yes, very much so.
I do, in fact, do that. Yeah. So I enjoy the conversation very much. Thank you for your comments. Thank you for your participation. We'll see you in a week. We'll be back here live on the 10th of April and have content for you throughout. So thank you, everybody. See you soon.